Hello and welcome back to Wrong Opinions Only with your hosts Justin and Kayla, and we're back and we're sober. We are not having the chaotic pod we did last week, even though it was a lot of fun, Kayla. We had some good times. We got some good feedback on it, but we're now back in the regular format here, recording in, talking about some shows and movies that we love.
You know, the people really spoke and they really enjoyed us just completely drunk off our asses in a mere hour. It was fun. We had a lot of fun. Craig was a champ for just joining us for the fun of it. You fulfilled your Oscar loss very quickly into the year. So that has freed you up, I will say. Will we do it again? Who's to say? Summer's coming in. But for now, that was quite a event. And I'm glad everyone enjoyed it. It was a good time. But in the meantime, once we sobered up, we went back to the screens and we went back to television, a show I actually referenced a couple episodes because I thought I was watching it and I ended up watching a completely different show and it took me like 20 minutes to realize. But I did finally return to the show Shogun that is on Hulu and it is an FX show. So I finally binged it. It had all been released at the point that I had gotten through it. You had were kind of caught up in watching it week to week, but I was very happy that we finally came together to finish the whole series, and we're going to talk about it today. We're also going to talk about a film that's been out for a little bit, that Challengers was in Daya. A lot of thoughts on that, but first, Shogun. Justin, overall, I'll go into some of the facts of what the show is about. We're going to talk a lot about it, but I want to know your thoughts of how you felt in general about it. But if you haven't watched Shogun, what's wrong with you? I've been telling everyone to do it. It's an American historical drama created by Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks. It's based on a 1975 book of the same name, and it was a miniseries too. So if the show name sounds familiar, it was a show in the 80s. The Shogun follows the collision of two ambitious men from different worlds. You have John Blackthorne, a risk-taking English sailor who ends up shipwrecked in Japan, a land whose unfamiliar culture was ultimately redefine him. And then you have Lord Torunaga, a shrewd, powerful lord at odds with his own dangerous political rivals, and Lady Mariko, a woman with invaluable skills but dishonorable family ties, who must prove her value and allegiance. So much said, and yet there's so much more beyond those words that I just stated. In general, Justin, what did you think of Shogun?
Phenomenal show, one of the best shows of the year, and I think it'll be on everybody's top five, top 10 list by the end of the year for sure. Really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the week-to-week nature that I watched it on. I basically watched the first three. I binged through those, and then I went week-to-week, and it was fun to just theorize what's going to happen. I didn't know about the previous, or I didn't watch the previous miniseries TV show, or obviously read the novel because I'm not as much of a reader, but really enjoyed the show. The cinematography was beautiful. It was just so well shot. The subtlety was really second to none. They didn't really feel the need to hit you over the head with dialogue, and they didn't have a whole bunch of just exposition. They really trusted the viewer to really pick up on the subtleties that were happening on the screen. And I just really loved it, Kayla. And I'm really glad that you finally got around to watching it.
Yes. And I'm going to talk a little bit why it took me a little bit to get into it, why I'm so glad I watched it, and a little conversation with you listeners, because I've been talking to people about the show, having finished it, like, you guys got to watch this show. And I'm coming across a lot of people that as soon as you say a show is in a different language or that subtitles are going to be on the screen, I can literally see their eyes glaze over. I mean, it's so funny the amount of people that are just completely turned off by having to read any text, that it distracts from the show, that it's annoying, whichever. And I just say, there's such a great amount of art, including this show, that you're just missing because you're closing yourself off to reading text. And as avid supporters of subtitles, we have subtitles on everything. We can't hear without our subtitles.
Yep. Very true.
You get used to it, and it's so undistracting. If anything, it helps clarify the constant rewind and pause you have to do with, what did they just say? Let me rewind real quick. It solves that so much. You don't even see it. I really don't. You just get so used to it. part of what I struggled with, which I'll admit to, is that you can't two-screen this show, meaning the language is primarily Japanese, ancient Japanese at that. So you can't pull out your phone, you can't read, check the weather, you can't look at the app, can't check your stocks. You have to be really centered in on this hour-long show, and there's 10 episodes in the show. It did take me some time because I think I was surprised at how much I do sometimes tend to be a two-screen when I'm watching television. So I really, you know, I'd get home from work and I'm like, okay, I have to like sit down and just stare at the screen for an hour to absorb everything. But I'll just say that was completely worth it. And when I started getting into it, I was just next episode, next episode. I finished the show at 1 a.m. I was so dedicated because it was just so good. It was so much fun to watch. So I just wanted to say that ahead of time for people that are hearing about the show and turned off by a different language or subtitles. It's completely worth it. It's action. It's emotional. It's historical. It's very interesting. So I just wanted to say that. But in general, my thoughts on Shogo is fantastic. I love shows that make me go, oh my God, what's going to happen? I love shows that make me sob, which actually happened towards the end of the series. And it had really interesting characters. There was growth. I mean, what's not to love?
Completely agree with you, Kayla. It really did such a great job at portraying such complex characters and relationships throughout. And I love being brought into a different world. Like, I don't know anything about 1600s Japan. So this was a great job of bringing you into it and seeing how these different cultures operate at a different time. And from what I've heard, the creators really did their diligence and made sure this was as historically accurate as possible to show on the screen. So they were very intentional in how they were showing the seppuku, the how they were interacting, the ancient language, the customs, the relationships. And it really carried through the screen. And I just, like I said, it's going to be at the top probably three shows for me by the end of the year, without a doubt.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's going to be a celebrated piece of television as well, because this show is really, everyone's talking about it, is a hit television show. Unsurprisingly, from the other hit TV shows that FX seems to put out, they really do great work. Gets me back to Hulu. So, you know, your kind of entry point into the show, of course, is the character Blackthorn, who speaks English in the show. He does learn more Japanese as he's kind of trapped, held prisoner, and then slowly kind of becomes immersed in the culture forcibly, and then of his own accord, we'll argue maybe towards the end, you know. But it's
100%.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny because he speaks English, but he's speaking Portuguese in the show, so that was very interesting to look up, you know.
Yeah, that's. I was a little confused the first like episode because they're like, all right. So some of the Japanese know Portuguese because of their relationship with the church. And obviously there's the Catholic Church side plot where they're trying to basically gain power and convert some of these Japanese locations. But they're talking in English. And thank you at least for having the Portuguese be in English. That helps make it adaptable and more acceptable for people to watch. Because if it was all subtitles and it's Portuguese to Japanese and back and forth with some English mixed in, that would have been more confusing. So I'm glad the way they did it. It just took me a second when they were talking. I'm like, wait, how does she know English if no English has ever? Oh, okay. No, she's talking Portuguese, and Portuguese is what I hear as English. Understood. But it is a little bit of a mind fuck at the beginning there.
Definitely, especially because he kind of comes there. He's a Protestant, English Protestant. He hates the Portuguese. And so it just was confusing to me because I'm like, he's speaking Portuguese. He hates them so much. And, you know, he's taken off his ship that he runs with his men. Something you'll hear him say about 1,000 times in the show is how much he wants to get back to his,
a little bit overdone,
his men and his ship. And I got to say at the end, he does not go back with his men and his ship. So sad story for Blackthorn. But I guess in general, there's a lot of characters in this show. I guess Torinaga, you know, he's the Lord. He's the one who protests too much. I don't want the power. I don't want a shogun, which is essentially like a, what would you call it? An all ruler. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
But basically like an emperor that oversees like everything. They have total control. And the way it's kind of formatted in the beginning is, right, the previous ruler wasn't a shogun because he didn't like take full control over everything, but he was the leader, the Tycho, right? But then when he died, he left it to a series of regents. So I think it was 5 regents, which are basically a board of directors, right? You guys need to work together in order to run the realm. And then it's a little bit of a, you'll hear this comparison a lot with the show. It's a little Game of Thronesy where you have all these different factions trying to figure out how to find the best way towards power, how to really set up their future, or what they're trying to get out of this transition of power benefits them and their people the most. And they're all trying to do it in a very sly, slick way. But Toranaga, who's kind of one of the main characters in the show, is just 5 steps ahead of everybody at all times.
Yes. And I wonder how you felt from the beginning to the end as far as his character arc, and whether you feel like he's a hero or a villain at the end of his great monologue at the end. I mean, essentially the Shogun 2 is like, there is an emperor around, but like you said, the Shogun's kind of like this regent. It's like, that's actually the position of power. And so Toranaga's whole spiel is how, I don't want it. The whole series, he's basically, they're trying to kill him. They're sick of him and how respected he is, and his, you know, ability to connect with people and the support. And you know, you have a lot of religious things coming into play too, because Catholicism's coming in, you know,
and his family lineage. Yes. It goes back in generations in Japan, which you kind of figure out throughout the show that how you were born, what type of family roots you came from, really does hold a lot of sway in where you get to go in this time period.
Yes, absolutely. And so, you know, you're constantly watching, you know, he's the leader in this group. And so he has some wins, he has some losses, he does a little, I'm fake sick, so he can't be taken to his death, you know, all these types of things. And he gets this, I guess, monologue at the end where you find out, again, it's always the, I don't want to be Shogun, I don't want it. And then at the end you find out, yeah, no, totally, that is my whole life's purpose, that the tons of people that have died in his service, willingly and unwillingly, sometimes he just kills people for fun, parts of the show, were all so he could get to this point of power. And he's giving this monologue to someone that has been constantly going against him and with him. And I guess, what did you think about him towards the end? Because in the beginning, I was liking him. I was rooting for him. And at the end, I was like, I didn't forgive him for a character death, for one, but really crushed me there.
So yeah, he is a very complicated character because he's not a true hero, he's not a true villain. He's got a little bit of Paul Atreides vibes going, I'm not gonna lie to you there, where he, in his mind, he is trying to stave off any massive bloodshed, any massive war here. So his strategy is, a couple people need to die in order for me to maintain peace in the realm and avoid thousands and hundreds of thousands of deaths, which, okay, that makes sense. But when he is so clearly using people and bending them to his will, that's where it gets hairy. And he is, in my opinion, a better ruler than Ishido would be, right? Ishido is just ruthless. He's keeping captives, he's not letting people leave, he's murdering them on the same route every day. It's really weird that everybody that leaves the castle and goes one direction ends up being hit by a whole bunch of bandits and dying. Maybe like clean that up, do something a little bit different, Ishido. But Toranaga is clearly much more respected and much long-term thinker, and he talks about how he has these relationships with the Falcons, and he talks about those throughout the show of, hey, you can either be somebody that's going out and seeking something for yourself, or you can just do what you're told, essentially. And these Falcons, they're doing what I tell them to do now, and they're coming back to me with the secrets, and that's what I'm turning you into, when he's talking to Blackthorn or Yabushige. And then it's just a great dynamic between how he's trying to use people's own spirituality and sense of purpose against them and for him. So Mariko, who is just the star of the show, she needs to be a superstar. She was amazing this whole show, just the subtlety in her performance, but she needs a purpose. She feels like she is not, she's tried to request seppuku or being killed or multiple times, right? And they will not allow her to do it. And he kind of steps in and says, I have a bigger purpose for you. This is your time. You can die with meaning now. And that's something that really, like, goes a long way with her, because she wants to die, but she wants it to mean something in the end. And that's just how he uses people's minds against them is so well crafted, which does turn villainy towards the last few episodes for sure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like him just beheading people so he can pretend that he wasn't the one that destroyed Blackthorn ship. So shout out to those poor villagers. Yeah, let's talk about Mariko, who I think, like you said, is the star of the show. I immediately locked into her in like the first episode. I gotta say, in general, the show's very, very does this well, where I don't really know much about Japanese culture going into the show, the history. So I'm kind of experiencing it like, wow, I don't know anything about how at this time, you know, how Japan was. And so I kind of felt, I hate to say it, a little like Blackthorn, where I'm just kind of watching all of these obviously very patriarchal systems. These very like, your wife is your property, you know, very limits to what you can do. If you shame someone, your whole, not just you, but your whole family line is murdered. It's very honor, dishonor, and you can dishonor something with one word. And the reality is you have to then say, I'd rather kill myself than dishonor, you know, this moment or you, my lord. And so it's very, I was hard to watch. Similarly with Blackthorn coming in as the Englishman, as a prisoner going, this is, you know, they're calling him, and the funny thing is they call him the barbarian, right? But of course he's watching some of these acts, like how uncultured, how barbaric, how, oh my God, horrifying. And then of course you see the trajectory of him learning the systems and learning the culture and even appreciating it and the people, which is just an amazing arc. And Mariko is this character who works as a translator. She's, Catholicism is a huge plot point in the series. As Catholicism starts coming over to Japan, the church starts gaining power. You have Blackthorn being against the Portuguese, and then just the Japanese, you know, beliefs and all of that. And so Mariko is turned Catholic after her father shamed and killed a regent to be, and he, you know, has shamed all her family has died, because the family dies when you shame something. And so she feels like, I'm the last person in my line. I want to join them. I don't want to live. She's separate. And so she just every year asks to die. And so, you know, what they had, that this is a character that wants to die. And yet when she does have this moment, like you mentioned at the end, where she does get a chance to serve a purpose with her death, she gets to save someone she loves and save, you know, people, and serve her Lord. Not just the Lord, but also her Lord in politics, Lord Torunaga. It's beautiful, but I sobbed so hard. And then they did this scene where she almost kills herself, and then she is saved. And then you think, oh, maybe she'll make it to the next episode. And then no, right at the end, she kind of sacrifices herself in a meaningful way, rough.
That they did that in the same episode was so freaking smart, because it just disoriented you just enough where you're like, oh, okay, maybe she'll get, oh, nope, never mind. She knows what needs to be done. And that scene that you mentioned where she was going to commit seppuku and she asked one of the regents who was associated with the church to be her second. And to be the second is obviously you slice your own belly, and then somebody there, your second, is to chop off your head so you're not like sitting there in pain and like agony. But that regent did not show up because it's against the Catholics' views to kill somebody like that. So she is sitting there like helpless and just trying to do this thing to say, per her Lord, and basically save further bloodshed and stop this war. And the whole show has been Blackthorn not really understanding the customs and saying, why would you kill yourself? This is stupid. Just stay alive. There's more to do in life. And the progression of him being a stupid Englishman to understanding the customs, slowly progressing his understanding of the language, was just so well done. And to close it out really with him in that moment, stepping up and saying, I will be your second. And it was just such a show of selflessness and love for her. And you could kind of see she is just so taken from that, saying, he finally understands that this is something I need to do. And then she saved. Like, she doesn't get killed. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, boom, listen, she just stands in front of a door that gets exploded. And you're like, what the hell?
There's a will they, won't they, the entire series between Mariko, who is set to be his translator, right? He does not speak Japanese. She's been working on her Portuguese. And so her lord asks her to translate what Blackthorn says. And so they get to, one, she's always there in these meetings that she wouldn't normally be. And then two, she has private conversations with them. Blackthorn is almost intolerable in attitude until the very end, that as much as I loved Mariko so and supported her, because she was married, but he was like abusive and really hard to have any kind of caring thought to him.
Buntaro?
Yes. And so when I was rooting for them, I'm like, I'm disgusted that I'm rooting for them, because he's very much like an idiot. Like, he's yelling all the time. He's so reluctant to understand why they do things. He's so superior in his thoughts of how the English do it better. And, you know, like you said, when he, you know, seppuku is just how you say it, when it's such a obviously intense way to commit suicide, and it involves you singularly stabbing yourself in the stomach, perforating your organs, right, which may or may not kill you as you slide it across, and then you get a second, you ask for someone to essentially behead you, right? And so what kills which part, who's to say? It's very violent, obviously, very painful way to die. And it's salted kind of throughout the series, right? And so many characters are so close. And so for her to have this moment where that's how she's going to die, right? And she's going to do it herself. And no one steps up to be her second, meaning that she may just painfully die, right? Because it's just her. And for Blackthorn, who at this point has asked her to stay alive for him, has like really fell in love with her and she with him, he steps up to be her second, which is like killing the person you love. That's horrible, but he does it for her because, again, it's saving her the pain of this death that she's going to do. And so that's beautiful in a way that's like, how do you make that beautiful? How do you make that an emotional moment, a selfless moment, when you are in such difficult conversation like suicide? And so the writing of the show is so good. Mariko's as a character was so fantastic and so caught in the traditions of Japan and her role as a woman. But you could see at one point she's mentioned, you know, her father wished she was a man because she, with her personality and her skill set, she could have been the shogun. Who's to say? And you could see it. You could see how if society, and, you know, so you do kind of look at it as an outsider, like, oh, if only another character, Fumi, could do what she wants to do. Like, you do feel for these women in the show, but they give such validation to the lives that they lead, even if it is a life of service, whether that's men, whether that's the cultural norms of being subservient. And I don't know. It's beautiful. I really learned a lot about Japanese culture. I mean, it's changed so much, obviously, to now, but I have a lot of respect for the differences, you know?
100% with you on that, Kayla. And having that tie-in of, all right, she's the translator, so she's your window into how you're going to operate through this whole world, because she is pretty much the only person, at least at the beginning, that Blackthorn can communicate with. And it doesn't really matter, because all he says is, I'm John Blackthorn. I would like to see my ships and my men, please. Yes, ships, men. Where are my men? Where are my ships? My men suck. Okay, never mind. I will stay here forever. But she, as the translator, such a cool choice about that is how she translates. And she doesn't always translate directly what people say. So she leaves some things out here and there, or she goes, oh, that's not the right way to say that. You're going to embarrass yourself. Let me massage it. And just those little tweaks where it's like, all right, I'm going to say this, but even though that's not exactly what you said, I'm going to kind of give it a little flavor, make sure that we're getting through this the right way. And you can tell through the way she's doing translations that she does care about Blackthorn and she is trying to help him, Or even when she stops, she goes, shut up, you idiot. Like, you can't say that here. Shut the hell up, man. And then you get that scene with Yabushige on the boat at the end where he turns to her and he's a little suspicious about it. And he goes, are you actually translating exactly what I tell you to or not? And you can see him starting to turn a little bit there. But I just love that choice. And I love her as an actress. And in the show, she was great. And I tried to look up other things she's been in. And I was surprised to see pretty much nothing besides Fast 9, apparently. I didn't realize. I don't remember her in Fast 9, Kayla. So if you know that, let me know. And then Pachinko, which was an Apple TV show I started, which was pretty good, but I have not gone through yet. And that is another show that is primarily in a different language, and it's a lot of subtitles and stuff. So I really hope we see more of her going forward.
I definitely think that we will. I mean, you know, language is, again, another, just like religion is another point in this show where it's a prison, right, for Blackthorne. No one understands him. He's beholden to not just Mariko as his translator, but a Catholic priest, Father Alvito, who, again, does not believe in Catholicism, is against it. And so he, you know, he's beholden to what they say he's saying. And in some points, the attempt is to get him killed at the beginning. They want him out of here.
Yeah, like the first episode. Yeah, they just say nonsense in order to try to get him killed because he's against the church. Yes. And then he can see what's happening and then immediately freaks out on everybody.
Yes. By the way, in case you couldn't picture who she is in Fast 9, remember when Han comes back and they find him and she's with someone?
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. That they're after her.
Now.
Yep, yep. And so, yeah, it just, that is so amazing. And the way that they have their conversations, again, no one can understand Blackthorne until he slowly starts learning Japanese towards the middle and end of the show. And even then it's very broken. And one episode is dedicated to a miscommunication that he has that involves someone dying, because of that. And so language is so important in this show and it's weaponized, right? And so I loved this show. And I want to shout out Fumi, too, who's just a great character. Love Fumi.
Fuji, you mean?
Fuji, thank you. Yep. She just, she's this character who, again, similarly, wants to die. Her husband and her child have been killed at the beginning of the episode, and so she wants to join them. She's given their ashes. That's what she wants. And instead, she's given away to Blackthorne as like we want to keep him here. He's not a prisoner. I mean, he can't leave, but he's not a prisoner. So he gets to have a consort, and he gets to have a house, and he's trapped there, basically. Like, can't leave, but here you go. And so their relationship, he's very like, no, don't. You're not subservient to me. You know, I don't want to have sex with you. And what is this? And so, you know, they form a relationship together where they're navigating language. They form their own language, I would say, you know. And so it's really nice. And even towards the end, she becomes a nun and he's doesn't want her to leave because at this point, Mariko has died. And she's like that last kind of woman in his life, that familiar person since he met Mariko. They have a sad scene where they're sitting at the house and they look over to the right where Mariko sat on this kind of pillow.
Such
and it's empty.
A touching scene.
And there's a scene where they go on a boat and it's like they're saying goodbye. And he brings her on a boat, right? The sea, loves the water, the boats. And he brings the ashes of her husband and child and says, let's, you know, release them to the water. So they're always here. And it's a very emotional moment. He lets go of the rosary that he got from Mariko when she kind of, you know, he held her in his arms. And, you know, he lets it go. I gotta say, I was very confused by the dream sequence at the end.
Okay. I literally in my notes said, I was confused the last episode with the rosary.
Yes.
Because he has it when he wakes up as an old man, but he throws it in the water. So what was the dream? The old man piece was the dream?
So in the episode, the last episode, right, you see that he is an old, it's a flashing throughout the episode where he's an old man, like 80s, dying his deathbed in England, you presume, because he has grandchildren in the room that are talking about his past. And because they're like, oh, grandfather, like, is it true that you're with the barbarians or something? And he's holding this rosary.
The savages.
The savages. Thank you.
Yeah.
And so, and he's like remembering. It's almost like, was this a dream sequence on his deathbed? I was perplexed by this because at the end you find out, you know, Torunaga has this whole plan where Blackborn's never going back to England. He, you know, Blackborn's now going to rebuild his ship that has been destroyed by Torunaga secretly. He doesn't know that. And presumably he's going to then sail off back to England. But Torunaga's like, no, I'm just going to keep sabotaging him. He's entertaining. And so I'm going to keep him here in Japan. And everyone knows he's not leaving Japan. So I thought that was real, even with the rosary falling into the water, because everyone says that's when you knew it wasn't real, as in maybe that was a dream of Blackborn maybe getting home and looking back at this time, but it's not real. I personally thought at the end of the episode when it finished that that was real, meaning that he dropped the rosary in the water and then he spent years maybe in Japan and it had maybe one day it washed ashore. Like, I did not think that was fake.
My interpretation, and I was confused the first time I listened to some other things and then kind of rewatched a couple scenes, but my interpretation was this flash forward and back with the old man Blackthorn, that was when he was knocked out from the blast, and that was a dream he was having of what could his life have been in the future, like in the future, but by the end of the show, my interpretation was that never actually happened, and he stayed in Japan his entire life and never made it back to England. So we had completely different interpretations on how that ended, which I think is interesting and kind of a smart way to do that, because it draws the dialogue and the discourse over the show.
Yes, it blew my mind when I was too listening to different podcasts and things and was like, wait a minute, that wasn't real? Somehow I still thought that was like a future. So that was very confusing to me. I personally don't think that was needed. To me, it just added confusion to it. I don't know if I felt differently to Blackthorn towards the end. But, you know, there's a lot of action. There's a lot of extreme violence in the show. There's the emotion of the Mariko and Blackthorn and just family and a lot of loss and honor and dishonor and what is correct and what isn't. And coming from an American culture, you know, you're watching it like, oh my God, like this is brutal. But to see, I as much as Blackthorn was very annoying, he's very much the, what is this? Let me get out of here. No, my ship. You know, I was annoyed by him so much. I felt with the Japanese people, like, get him out, like, kill this man. He's so annoying. But towards the end, he has such love for the culture. And even though he's lost Mariko, his main tie to this place, the main way he survived by translating, he's seemingly, you can see a future where he finds a life for himself that's fulfilling, and maybe he meets someone or maybe he doesn't, but I could see him being a part of this place. And I think that's amazing.
Well, you have that scene where they're pulling the boat out of the water, which really, that is a little bit of a touch of, okay, he is working with other people in the community when he doesn't have anybody. He's finding ways to communicate with them. Buntaro comes down and helps, and you kind of have that sharing glance between the two of them where it's like, I may not like you, but I respect you enough. And Mariko really respected in you. So I'm going to let this slide right now, because Buntaro has wanted to kill that guy since the moment he set eyes on him. Well, obviously he also slept with his wife, but we won't go down that rabbit hole right now. And there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of death and some gore, but the way it was done, right? They kept talking about Crimson Sky, and I think they're leading the viewer like, oh, there's going to be this massive battle. No, knowing Torunaga, though, I, throughout the show, was like, there's got to be a twist here. There's got to be a twist with this Crimson Sky. And you find out at the end, it was, I am sending Mariko in there, and the Crimson Sky is, she will die if she needs to in order to win this war. We do not need to try to go into Osaka and have all these different forces fighting each other, because if she goes down or if she is not let out, all of the other families, all of the other regents are going to see how Ishido is operating, and they're going to turn against him. And it was just such a smart play where everybody was thinking it was one thing, but really Torunaga again is five steps ahead and just had a clear path outlined from the very beginning.
And I do want to say something I was thinking as I was watching the show, you know, about the brutalness of, you know, all different acts that they're doing, right? What I thought was really cool is how traditions and, you know, honorisms and the different ceremonies worked against them in so many ways. For example, when Torunaga is essentially getting ready to be taken prisoner and taken to be executed, right? His son dies and then he gets like 45 days to grieve. And I'm like, 45 days to plot, essentially? And he gets to free reign, kind of. There's a scene also where they are completely surrounded in this town because they're going to take him away. And they give a letter like, your son needs to kill himself. You're being taken to be killed. And then they get like a whole day to think about it and then give an answer the next day. And not only are you like, you're trapped in this house until you give me an answer, they're like freely able to have all these side conversations and plots. And I'm just like, what? Like, you give this ultimatum, you're surrounded, but you get to like get a group together to say like, how are we getting out of this? And the Mariko, you know, she goes there. They're like, you can't leave. And she's like, I'll kill myself then because I can't. My Lord told me to come back and you're not letting me with these people. And the horror of letting this woman who was celebrated and known to be someone who always follows the rules and is so pious and all this stuff, this Catholic woman, is going to kill herself and they're just going to let her instead of letting her leave. They can't even bear it. And then when she does die in an attempt to kidnap her, their whole plot is ruined. Ishido's like, I don't, like, they're done. So much so that the woman who has the hair, right, the heir, you know, who essentially is like a
Oshiba.
Yeah, Oshiba. Oshiba Nokata, she turns on him in that moment for her love of Mariko and also for the fact that he let her die in this plot to kidnap her. So I just think it's so interesting how in some ways it's such a, you know, a beautiful scenes of tea making, you know, cha happening. And then also the way that Torunaga is able to completely foil them every time, like, I'm sick. Or his son dies and he's more like, oh, I get 45 days to plot how I'm going to get out of this. You know, it's.
And then he's like, I got other sons.
Yeah,
no,
like, they're like, yeah, they're, you know, the fact that they're just like constantly saying, you know, to kill themselves. And then they're also like, oh, but no, you need 45 days to grieve. Like, we allow you, even if you're on death's door, we need to give you those days to grieve. Yeah. Even though we're going to kill you at the end of that, like, you get your time. What? It just, that was so funny to watch, you know?
It's just that level of respect for people at a certain rank in at that time in Japan. And I think it needs to be said that Ishido's a freaking idiot. Like, he saw nothing coming. He just screwed the pooch every single time. I mean, how about when Torunaga's like, I'm resigning? And he's like, yes, sweet. And then immediately he's like, oh, crap. No, it specifically says five people need to vote to have me killed now. And there's only four members of the regions. Crap. Like, that's such a simple move. He's just like, I'm just going to resign and you guys can't do anything about it until you agree on somebody else. And it's just, Ishido is so far behind every single step. And then you had Yabushige, who was a great character, very entertaining character for the show, who is just kind of your conduit back and forth between Torunaga and Ishido, where he's trying to play both sides the whole time. But both people know he's playing both sides the whole time. So really, it's just a matter of when he's going to die because he's going to cross the wrong person. But he just keeps doing that back and forth, back and forth. And then has a mental breakdown and some PTSD or whatever after he is the reason that they are trying to kidnap Mariko and she dies. It's because he let the what was the term for basically the ninjas he let in order to try to kidnap and kill her. And he just can't deal with it. And he has to, at the end, commit seppuku himself with Torunaga graciously deciding to be his second, which is, I guess, kind of an honor in that moment. So he's somebody who the whole show was trying to find ways to further himself in like states of power and find, get away on the Council of Regents and all of this stuff, but was also a complete idiot. But he somehow was able to get that high up in the rank. So it's like, not everybody is as smart as Toranaga,
which,
you know?
Honestly, he was my second favorite character because he was the comedy. He was the one constantly, on death's door, constantly someone was about to tell him to please, you have to go commit seppuku, you know? And so he constantly was narrowly avoiding death, and he constantly was shifting sides and stabbing people behind the back. And they also were all aware that he was doing this. It became like a joke of Toranaga knowing that he was plotting against him several times until he gets to a point where he's like, enough's enough, you're done. And I get to unload on you what my true ambitions are because you're going to kill yourself, and that's how it goes. I loved him. I loved the actor. I just thought he was so important to the show to give that comedy, to give that, is he going to get out of this again? And somehow he would, all the way to the end. And then the fact that he gets to hear the true intentions of Toranaga at the end was just so fitting. And he even despite knowing he's going to die, asked questions and, you know, just to be in that mindset, even when he is, you know, only his nephew betrays him in the end and actually gets him to get to this death. He says, you know, I loved you like a son, and tries to give his wealth to him. And, you know, I just, even people that betray you, you have love for, you respect and honor. I just, there's so much to say about the show, you guys. You really need to watch it. It was phenomenal. It's about love. It's about cultural differences. There's violence. It's like we've compared it to Game of Thrones, but I highly, highly recommend the show. Any other thoughts, Justin, on Shogun?
Oh, last thing I just want to say is Rodriguez, the Portuguese sailor, was on a heater. The two episodes he was in, he was hilarious. I kind of wish he came back like for a scene or something towards the end, but just such a well-done show, and I really hope they just end it. They don't try to stretch out the Toranaga, the Blackthorn saga at all. End it here. If there is going to be a future season, I know there's other books that came out that are in different timelines, hundreds of years in the future. That's okay, but do not give me the same characters. Do not run this back. This was such a beautiful season of television, and it ended perfectly.
So the show is the season one, obviously very, very successful. However, the series did pretty much cover the entire book. There's no really room to add more to. The writer, however, wrote several books, all taking place in different time periods of Japan. And so there's potentially some room there for another book of his to be adapted, and it could be a future time from this period, or maybe even before. Would you be interested in a show like that, in a Shogun type world, but a different story, different characters?
Yeah, I would 100% be interested, especially if the same level of care went into adapting it as it did with this season of television, because you really need to be diligent about how you're going to show the culture, how you're going to show the relationships. And this was just done so well. If they're able to get even close to that in a different time period, I'm all in.
Me as well. I was tempted to get the book. However, I lately have been buying every book that is a TV show is based off of in a movie, and my Dune itself is staring me in the face right now. And I read a couple of chapters and then kind of fell off. So I'm telling myself, Kayla, finish reading the books you have before you buy another. But I just was so interested in this world and want to kind of see the differences in the book, because there were quite a bit of differences. You get to see a lot of the internal thoughts, you know, and so I'm excited to look into that at some point when I get through these books here.
And it's loosely based, yes, on the true story, like you said at the beginning.
These are real historical figures that these characters, mm-hmm, are reflecting. And so that's very interesting to me. Let's go ahead and jump into a film that we have a lot of thoughts on, and that is Challengers. Let's go. All right, so Challengers is a romantic sports drama directed by Luca, let's see if I butcher this, Guadagnino. Did I make it that Italian? It may be, but... Hey,
Luca Guadagnino.
Follows a professional tennis champion played by Mike Feist, who plots a comeback with the help of his wife Zendaya, a former tennis prodigy who retires after an injury, as he goes up against another player played by Josh O'Connor, who also happens to be his former best friend and wife's former lover. Came out April 26th. We saw this like a day or two before it officially released. What did you like or dislike about this film in general, Justin? It is a threesome movie. It's not a threesome movie. It's sports. It's triangle. It's
sexy tennis, but is. Not a lot of sex, but yes. Some tennis. But it was fun at the movies, Kayla. Bring me to the cinema again, all right? This was just electric. It was entertaining. I was engaged the whole time. You had some ideas where the plot was going, but not exactly. There were a couple curveballs. It was shot very interestingly. The soundtrack, the score was super unique. It kind of just was throbbing the whole time, which really kind of just set a different level of like excitement throughout the show and like anxiety. So I really enjoyed this movie, Kayla.
This movie was so fun to watch in theaters. Now, I'm a big fan of Zendaya. When I looked at the trailer and the poster, and physically, I will say these, none of these people are really my type. There's definitely like someone has expressed it was a sexy movie if you like skinny people. And you do kind of look at Josh O'Connor and Mike Feist and go, would they be capable of landing Zendaya? That was my initial thoughts going into the movie. I was like, this just seems so unrealistic that she could be in this triangle with these two, not horrible looking, but just doesn't seem on her level, her model-esque pedestal there. However, you get to see, you know, throughout the movie, Mike Feist, of course, was in. I was like, why does he look so familiar that I remember from West Side Story? So he's a great singer and dancer as well. And Josh O'Connor as this kind of sleazy version. It was just so good. It was, as you said, like sexy, but very little sex, because it's very much a sports analogy of competition and sweating and sports being like sex, that like control, that thrill of when you're winning, that euphoria, complicated by best friends who are into the same woman, you know?
Euphoria. I see what you did there.
Hey, a show I couldn't get into, but yes. And, the verbal fights that they have, the writing of this movie was so well done, because there are many scenes between two characters, whether it's Zendaya, one of the guys, or the two guys, that you are just enamored on the screen of what's happening, because they are saying these quick lines, just like tennis, back and forth. And they are like brutal. They're like, how you accomplished nothing. I don't even think of you. Like it is phenomenally painful to hear these words. And they just throw it like easy words back and forth throughout the movie. I love that.
That is such a good way to put it, Kayla, because it is them volleying back and forth, like in their dialogue, in their actions, in the story. It's going back between present day and different timelines. It is very much like tennis. You're just volleying back and forth between these relationships, between these timelines, between these characters and their ambitions and their desires. And that's what it comes down to, right? It's a movie about ambition and desire. And what are you going to do to get what you want? And when everything's taken from you, how do you get that? And you see a couple scenes with Zendaya, because basically the premise, right? She meets these guys when they're all 17. She dates Josh O'Connor's character, Patrick, for a while, and then eventually moves on to Mike Feist's character, Art, which I feel is just a terrible name, honestly, is for a tennis player. But anyway, she is the star. She is so much better than them. And she has a conversation where she is like, tennis is beautiful. It's like, it almost turns her on in a way, right? She's like, where I was playing
Turn her on. She is so fucking hot for tennis and competition.
She is. And she's like playing the one girl in a match, and it's going back and forth, and they have this great volley. And at the end of it, she just like belts out like, yeah, like let's go. And you can tell she's like so into it. And then another time at Stanford, Patrick is back with her, like when they're dating. And they're getting it on. They haven't seen each other in a little while. And she's like on top of him. And as they're kind of going at it, she's talking to him about tennis. why didn't you do this? Why did you should have did this? What about this? And you can tell he's not into it that way. He's just kind of like, can we not talk about that? Like, I'll figure it out myself. And she just kind of gets off. She's like, all right, I'm done here then. And is like, walks away. And it's just such a cool dynamic. Her character is so unique in how she handles all these relationships. I thought it was so well done.
Because it's so clear that she gets off on power and control, and that the excitement of people pushing themselves to their limit and being ambitious and trying to get to the top, like, that's what excites her, I think, sexually and just personally. And so when Patrick isn't doing it for her, she goes to Art. When Art seems like he's slipping in his ambitions and just kind of wants to be a stay-at-home dad, her interest goes down to zero. Her libido's nothing. And I just love, like,
she's basically like, if you lose, I will leave you. Like, she says that at one point.
And the discourse online about, is Art boring? Is he terrible? Is he the hero? Did he get her to get injured? Is Patrick really a good guy? I mean, it just is so funny to me reading this stuff. I also love that I knew it early on, obviously. I mean, there's a whole scene where Art and Patrick are making out. Zendaya kind of manipulates them to be three-way kissing, and then she kind of slowly fades, lays down as they're just making out with each other. I kind of liked the, like, super like homoerotic vibes of this threesome too, meaning like they were the guys were very comfortable being like this close to each other. It was almost these vibes of like, are they gonna get together? They're eating each other's food. They have a physical closeness. They're constantly showing up for each other. And it never goes there. And I just thought that was such an interesting way to show male friendship in a way that's like, we love to fuck with each other, even if it does like cross a weird line, but like, it's never like a conversation. Yeah. They never make out. Like, I don't envision they had this makeout session and then like got back and had a talk about it where they're like, oh, I mean, do you like me? I just feel like they're like, that no. was hilarious. And then they're like, I'm going to try to get her tomorrow. And I kind of love that. You don't see that in movies.
So true. And it's like, there was a sexual energy, like a charisma between the two of them. And it was very fluid, right? It's the relationship between Patrick and Art. It's the relationship between Zendaya and Patrick, between Zendaya and Art, and how all three of them are intertwined. And every time there's a conversation with Art and Patrick, or majority of the time, like, the camera just like zooms in on their face and it shows you how close they are. It's like they're on the, like you said, on the verge of kissing sometimes, but just in casual conversation because they are so comfortable. Or even when he shows up at Stanford and he's chasing Art around, like, playfully kind of like playing grab ass with his buddy, essentially. And you see the other tennis players are kind of like, this is a little weird. Like, what the hell is going on? But they're just like so into each other as friends, but it could be more, but it never quite crosses that line. I mean, but you wouldn't be surprised if it did.
There's a churro scene that was pretty much, I was like, oh my God. And I just, again, you don't see that in movies where, you know, any other movie drama, it would be this conversation where they're like, one's in love, like he's going for Zendaya, but really he's in love with Patrick or vice versa. Like, you could see that movie as it was happening. And so what I just really loved is that although Zendaya had this back and forth with these two constantly and throughout her marriage with Art, when she did settle on one, they also had their own verbal turn on, you know, they constantly, like, they're just spewing back and forth these horrible things about themselves. And yet you could see, like, they were excited at hurting each other. And so when you do get this overall back and forth, there's a lot of flashbacks. As you know, flashbacks are hard for me, not as bad as time travel, but I was a little like, uh-oh, they go back and forth a lot. You have to tell by the haircuts. I think I had one point I turned to you and I go, is this now or before? And you'd help me out.
Yeah, that the timelines were not too difficult, but there was a couple weird ones, like the Atlanta sequence, which it's supposed to be like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years before the present day. That wasn't super clear, but that is one where I just picked up because they had a mention earlier on, like, oh yeah, well, back in it, did you tell them about Atlanta yet? So it was a little bit hard to follow at certain points when they mixed in some of those kind of interim timelines and it wasn't just pure, they're 17, they're 20 or they're 35. Those were kind of like the three timelines that we were hopping between. But then there was a couple other ones that kind of popped up here and there to show that Zendaya ran into good old Patty Boy at the hotel and hooked up with him one night. And our guy, Art, knew what happened, never mentioned it to anybody, and just kind of went into his room and sulked, I guess. I don't know. And then you have in the present day when Zendaya steps out on him for Patrick again in the monsoon crazy hurricane thing that's happening.
It's like a tornado,
which was insane.
Happening,
I'll let you go into
and
that.
Then they were like, let's have sex. I mean, the whole time I'm like, I thought a cow was
He hasn't showered in weeks.
At one point I thought a cow was passing them in the air. And I'm like, you guys are going to be lifted off the ground and thrown 100 feet. But they were just like, let's have sex in this car right now. I'm like, you shouldn't be on the streets. What are you doing? Go inside. Take shelter. Yep. Like, I'm just like, what is happening? Now, Zendaya, it's an interesting character with Zendaya because at this point, she's left Patrick, you know, because his ambitions were zero. He just kind of want to fuck around and figure it out. And Art was the one who's serious. So she goes with Art, but, you know, Art doesn't really have a lot of ambitions. And so when it looks like his career is starting to go down, he's just like, I think this is it, you know.
But it's shown that Art was a multi-Grand Slam winner in tennis.
Yes.
Like he's somebody who is not like the best of all time, but he's won multiple Grand Slams, and the only one he hasn't won is the U.S. Open, which is the loose kind
of... Aiden, of course.
Can he get back to that spot?
You know, Zendaya gets injured, horrific scene. I was worried the whole time when it was going to happen. And she becomes the coach, right? And so Patrick at the end wants, hey, come over to me and help be my coach. And so, you know, you have this scene at the end where, you know, here's my theory with the Art and the reveal of why he's smiling when he finds out that Zendaya cheated on him most recently. I'm sure knows that she did before because he caught them at dinner. And then when he looked over, they were gone and she didn't come back to the hotel. So I'm sure he knows what happened there. And so I think that he was kept in the dark a lot with Zendaya. Like he saw that scene in Atlanta. He had to ask her, are you going to leave me if I do retire? And he's not really convinced that what she's saying, she's like, no, she looks disgusted at the fact that he won't be competing anymore.
She has all the control in that relationship.
I think he loved that. Patrick does just a great scene of a secret reveal where he puts the ball in between his tennis racket to show that he had sex with Zendaya.
I'm sorry to cut you off quick, but that scene, everybody in the theater knew it was coming. We all knew it was happening, and they just dragged it out so...
Like
this
sex.
Is where,
it was foreplay. It was plot.
It was
foreplay. Yes.
They just dragged it out, and you're like, they slow-mode, and it took like 10 minutes for us to get from like him going to serve, and you're like, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's just like, just edge a little bit longer. Just keep edging. Keep edging. Here it is.
And then I'm going to give it to you. Yeah, the payoff is going to be great because they were euphoric after that. so much so they had to hold each other after. And so it was, I think Art just like was so happy at like someone's being honest with me, you know? And it was... What do you think happened at the end? Okay, the game's ruined. I think our Patrick wins by default if this was like real tennis. Zendaya's like fucking basically came in her tennis shorts at the at them really competing at the end. What do you think happens when the crowd disperses?
So I love that they ended it the way they did and we didn't see what happens, but the Art freaking out, like just letting a point happen, taking a beat, and then just like hitting a serve as hard as he can, like at Patrick's face and missing. And then that back and forth, the volley where they're like going all out. And you see Zendaya just, like you said, she's just like so aroused. She's like, oh my God, this is tennis. This is like, they have the passion. They're both going after it here. And they're both, which is a really weird move, both jumping towards the middle of the net to go for the last ball and they embrace at the end. What happens? So I've watched this scene a few times. It looks like the ball may land on Patrick's side, but also you can't just jump over the net, which is what Art did. Art is the one who crosses the net. So I assume he forfeits the point when he does that. I don't really know the rules on something like that.
What do you think happens to them romantically, though?
Yeah,
Once he knows his wife cheated on him with his ex-best friend/may they get together. Here's what I think should have happened. First of all, they should have at some point had a conversation where like, let's be poly because we're clearly all into each other. Let's make it work. That is really how it could, I think, successfully end. But I don't know. I could see her Zendaya just
confusing for the daughter that Art and Zendaya have, maybe, though.
The poor kid. I mean, the poor kid. She's probably left at the hotel. I don't know what's happening because they're all going to have group sex after this. Zendaya's like, yes.
Yeah, are they? Can they just be friends after that? They're just like, oh yeah, I know you were sneaking around with my wife. I know she was sneaking around with you. How about we just maybe this is what happens. They leave Tashi and they just become a couple. Patrick and Art and Tashi is left just a stay-at-home mom.
And then they just have to co-parent. Yeah, because I really think Zendaya doesn't end up with either of them. I think they get divorced and she goes coaches another like younger successful tennis player. I think that's how it works
100%.
Yeah, just great stuff. Really enjoyed this film. I hope everyone gets a chance to see it. What did you rate this film, Justin?
So I rated this 3.5 out of 5 VHS tapes. I may need to see it again because it was a lot of fun. The one thing I pushed back on, and we talked about this after the movie a little bit, is I thought they went a little bit overboard with the slow motion and the score where you couldn't even hear conversation sometimes because it was just a throbbing.
We didn't talk about the soundtrack, which thank you for saying that is a biggest flaw we just did. The soundtrack, the music is, especially in the tennis scenes, has a Trent Reznor like electronic dance house music. And sometimes the conversations, the dialogue is kind of overshadowed by this house beats electronic music as it leads to a tennis match. It's like, that's the transition. It is very like jarring. I personally loved the music. I felt like I wanted to dance in my seat. It amused me every time because it played so much during the tennis scenes that when you did hear it during a conversation, you know it's because it's that fucking thrill of competition. So if they're verbally sparring and that music hits, it's they're getting that same feeling they do when they're on the court. And I just thought that was such a cool way to show, like, you anticipate, you're like, oh shit, like, you know what? This movie was sexy without sex. And when I say that, I mean, there's so many ways this movie's trying to get you in a certain vibe and frequency. I'm just realizing as we're talking about this, like even the music.
And like some of the cool shots where you were at the perspective of the tennis racket, of the tennis ball, were so interesting and unique. And like, you don't see that done a lot in movies and were so cool. I just think they should have utilize that for a couple key moments instead of like over and over again having this crazy scene where you're twirling around or you're seeing it from a different perspective or the music is hitting. But I think I need to see it again and see if that changes, because everybody I'm hearing talk about this movie loves the score, the music, how that was done. So maybe I just was a grump the first time I saw it. I don't know. But like I said, I still loved it. I gave it 3.5 out of 5 VHS tapes. I was close to going 4. I think you ended up going higher.
Yes,
than me, right,
I went
Kayla?
4. I was so entertained. I liked all the different changes. I liked that we became the ball, though my motion sickness, I was like, oh God, please don't let the camera be the ball for too long or I'm going to vomit into my popcorn. Just very entertaining. I wonder if I'd be higher if I watched it again. I don't know, but I love that theater like buzz. Like, this is great. You know, yeah. I want
to
yell like Zendaya, come on!
I can't believe I looked at the recent box office numbers. I wish it was doing better. It was only at like $35 million on a $50, $55 million budget. So we'll see. This could be a movie that people see multiple times, though, especially if it stays in theaters.
And I think it almost makes me want to get into tennis, I got to say. It was fun.
I do love tennis. Also, if you haven't watched, there's the Breakpoint, which is a documentary on Netflix where they follow tennis players throughout the season. The second season just came out. That's interesting. I wish the characters were a little bit more fun and entertaining, but some of it's pretty good. And just one scene I want to throw out here before we finish off this movie review is the scene where obviously Tashi's supposed to be the best. She gets hurt. Now she's coaching and she wishes she could be out there. When she was at Stanford, she dominates this girl in tennis match to win the you know, amateur US Open, whatever it was. And then later on, where it's, I don't know if it was present day or one of those interim timelines, you see on the screen, I think it's the present day, this girl that she beat when she was 17 or 18 dominated. The girl didn't stand a chance against her, is just dominating women's tennis. They're like, oh, she is just the queen of women's tennis. She wins another major. And then it just kind of cuts to her and she like turns off the TV. It's just like, shit, that could have been me. And now this girl who doesn't deserve it as much as I do is stealing my spotlight. And it's just like her whole mentality, the whole movie is just like, win. Go out there and do what you can to win.
Yes,
and
it's
I just love that.
I think it's essentially the makeout scene in a plot point, meaning that she can't play tennis, right? She has this injury that has ruined her career. But she can control these men and try to get the feeling that she used to get from playing, that she literally describes like sex. She can have the boys do it, and it's giving her that feeling. And so that makeout scene where she's leaning back and they're kissing each other is essentially what she's doing the whole rest of the movie. It's just using them to get off, to get that euphoria, that excitement yep. she got that she can't get herself anymore. So great movie.
She is the queen and they are her pawns,
yes,
that's
yes.
for sure.
Great stuff. So I want to know Tom Holland's thoughts, that's for sure. All right, let's go ahead and get to our Swirly of the Week. All right, I'm going to go right now because I pretty much have a swirly off the movie we just reviewed, which again is just my understanding that you have Art, the kind of good guy but boring, just can't get Zendaya there, can't help her reach that peak. You have Patrick, who's just a fuck boy, and she just loves the thrill of like, you could be great, but you're not. And I just think, again, they could have been in poly heaven together and instead chose to just suffer all singularly. So they're my swirlies.
Fair mm-hmm. enough. My swirly of the week this week is going to be, I'm not sure exactly how to phrase this, but athletes with their personal branding nowadays. So specifically the one that jumps out to me. So there's a lot of documentaries going out there. A lot of athletes now have their own podcast. They have their own documentaries that they're producing or they're executive producing. They have their own shows, their own YouTube channels, whatever it is. And it just is ruining the stories. We're not getting true interesting stories because we have this kind of veil from all of the actual athletes where they're trying to show themselves in the best light. So they're not giving the gritty truth underneath it. And the thing that really brought it to my mindset this week was Patrick Beverley. He's an NBA player who has his own podcast, and he is a subpar NBA player. He's played on a lot of teams. He's like, not a guy who's very good. He's a guy who talks a lot of shit. He talks more than he actually plays, right? And he was at a post-game press conference the other day in the NBA playoffs, and there was a woman reporter who asked him a question, and he goes, "Are you subscribed to my podcast?" She goes, "No, I'm not." And he goes, "All right, well, I'm not answering questions from you. You can leave." You can't just kick reporters out for not being subscribed. Like, what a shithead thing to
do. Was he being serious? Like, was it a joke?
100% serious, and like tried to had her removed. And nobody stuck up for her or anything. And apparently throughout the season on this team he's on, he's been doing that to reporters a lot. Like, "I'm not going to answer your questions if you don't subscribe to my podcast." Like, this is just the power that they have when these stupid little things is so ridiculous to me. Like, dude, are you kidding me? It kind of goes hand in hand with journalism nowadays, right? We can't have legit journalism because nobody wants to make enemies with the athletes because they need information from them. But the athletes aren't going to give them anything because they can just tell things the way they want to on their own terms. And then you're getting this softened kind of like the light shining brightly on you perspective, and you're not getting the real truth behind it. And it just really has ruined some stories and documentaries that I've seen lately. And I just wish we could stop this, or people would be more respectful to the journalism aspect of these things than they currently are being.
I agree. Just keep it out of sports. Give your interviews. Don't be rude. I mean, we personally have cut out everyone in our lives who don't listen and support the podcast, but that's us. You know, we're not athletes. So get it together.
Exactly. We're not making hundreds of millions of dollars, no. Guys. Like, we're making $0 from this podcast. So help us out.
Help us out. Subscribe, like, and subscribe. Let's go ahead and get to our friendship question of the week, which is bringing it back to Shogun. If we were a Blackthorn, meaning, how hard do you think it would be to immerse yourself in another country and language? Do you think we'd get along like Blackthorn?
So, and the caveat we put with this is we'd have really no history with the language. So if we took Spanish in school, it wouldn't be a Spanish or like a derivative of Spanish. So like we'd be dropped in Japan or Germany or Russia or something where we have no connection. I would be a disaster, Kayla. I don't know why. I can barely understand people if they have like a little bit of an accent, a southern accent, an accent from a different country and speaking clear and obvious English. I struggle to comprehend and hear people properly. If I'm in a different country, I don't know the language, I can't read anything, I would be having a mental breakdown. I would be freaking out on a date. I'd be calling my wife, be like, I need you here to be my Mariko. I need you to be my translator. I don't even know. You can probably figure out this language quicker than me. I would be freaking out, Kayla. I would be a disaster, and I'd be terrified and probably a hermit in my room, afraid to leave and say the wrong thing to anybody.
Wow, that's not what I was expecting from you. Okay, interesting. See, I think where I would struggle with is that I am very much an introvert. So, like, I think an extrovert has the best success of going to a different country because you're not afraid to fail. You're not afraid to go, what is this? Like, and lift stuff. And what I would be so like nervous to like approach people and get it wrong or like they don't understand me that I would avoid. So I probably wouldn't eat because I wouldn't go out and order anything unless I could like
find a Mickey D's.
Unless I could circle and point. I would be afraid to approach people and like just work on conversations. So I think in that way it would be a struggle for me. Like, I'd rather do without than be in an awkward situation. So that would be hard. I mean, parts of you like are excited at the thought of like just figuring it out, but then I'm like, oh my god, no, please.
Yeah, it seems like conceptually, like, that'd be so cool, throw me in that situation. Then when I actually think about it, I go, when I travel with my wife, she is great at this. She's like, I'm going to try to speak the language like a little bit. Like, I'm going to try to say key phrases or order in the language. I get such anxiety of like, I'm mispronouncing it. They're going to laugh at me, which is stupid because who gives a shit, right? But you can't tell your brain that in certain moments, right? And I'd like to think I'd be more of that extrovert. I'd be more outgoing. I'd like just fully immerse myself in the culture. But then based on my previous experiences, I just don't see myself doing that.
Maybe it's because of our issues with control, and that's very like an uncontrolled state that you're in, meaning you...
I think you just nailed it, Kayla. Yeah. I think
that's
it.
Why we... I'm picturing us being in like the same country, but like different cities, and we're just like, oh my God. And being like, we'll meet each other in the middle here in a week. And we're both like so hungry and thirsty, and we're like, get us out of here. We barely make it on the train to the right place. We're in whole different towns. And we agreed to, so yeah,
because we're afraid to tell yes. people we're actually getting off at the wrong stop. Yes. We're just like, ah, we're just gonna go until it ends.
And we overpaid it. I mean, I feel like this is so sad, but I got my first taste of it going to Atlanta because it was the first time I traveled by myself, meaning like playing
Atlanta,
by
Japan.
Myself,
gotcha, okay.
Figuring out how to get to the hotel by myself. Yeah, and it was harrowing. So I don't think I could survive. I'm with you.
Well, I guess I had like a slight experience in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. right? Before I met up with people in my MBA program, there was like a day or two where I was by myself and I was texting or calling the wifey and I'm like, man, and she was helping me from freaking thousands of miles away because I had that anxiety of like, I'm walking around, like checking things out. But I'm like, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to pronounce this. I don't know how to do this. I don't know where to go. It was like, if you're with somebody, it makes it significantly easier. But being just solo in a spot, it's just, that'd be a lot to handle. But, you know, I'm sure you'd grow pretty quickly and learn pretty quickly out of just pure necessity.
Well, maybe one day we'll know. Hopefully not. So, all right. I think that wraps it up for our episode this week. Go check out Shogun. Go watch Challengers. And as always, we'll see you next week.
Well, that's it for this episode of Wrong Opinions Only. Please follow us on Instagram at Wrong Opinions Only and on Twitter at Wrong Opinions JK, where we'll be dropping some clues and hints to upcoming episodes. Until then, JK out. Thank you.